negative, hostile, or even hopeless and depressed right before their periods begin. In my clinic, we call them the crying over dog food commercials days, because even silly, sentimental things can trigger a tearful response during this short time. At first, this abrupt mood change takes girls like Shayna by surprise. Teens think that all they need to know about the menstrual cycle is to remember their Tampax and take Advil or Aleve for the cramps on the day the blood flow starts. The idea that even when they're not bleeding, there could be brain effects from their cycling hormones takes some getting used to. By adulthood, they know how to handle it. Most women know that, in weeks 3 and 4, angry impulses fall under the 2-day rule. They'll wait 2 days and see if they still want to act on them. It took another few days for Shayna to realize she should not have spoken to her mother the way she did. And as her progesterone cycled out and her estrogen came back up, her irritability began to wane. Connections were once again sprouting in the hippocampus, and her brain gears were greased and working to full capacity. Pretty soon she was surprising everyone with her wisecracks and smart alecky remarks, and they were getting her into a bit of trouble. The boys just couldn't keep up at times, and she was riding the edge with the girls. Brain performance in some females can fluctuate with the hormonal changes of the menstrual cycle. One of the most estrogen-sensitive parts of the brain, the hippocampus, is a major relay station for processing memories for words. This may be one biological reason behind women's increased verbal performance during the highest estrogen week, week 2, of their cycles. I often joke with my female grad students that they should take their oral exams on day 12 of their cycles, which is the peak of their verbal performance. Maybe the same should go for teen girls and the SATs, or for wives wanting to win a fight with their husbands. Why the teen girl brain freaks? Think about it. Your brain has been pretty stable. You've had a steady flow or lack of hormones for your entire life. One day you're having tea parties with mommy, the next day you're calling her an asshole. And as a teen girl, the last thing you want to do is create conflict. You used to feel like a nice girl, and now, out of nowhere, it's as though you can't rely on that personality anymore. Everything you thought you knew about yourself has suddenly come undone. It's a huge gash in a girl's self-esteem, but it's a pretty simple chemical reaction, even for an adult woman. It makes a difference if you know what's going on. The trouble for some women is caused by estrogen and progesterone withdrawal in the brain, which happens in the 4th week of the cycle. The hormones bottom out precipitously, and the brain begins yearning for their calming effects. When it doesn't get them, the brain becomes irritated, so irritated it's on the same spectrum of discomfort as a seizure. This is true in a small percentage of women, to be sure, but it's not fun. So stress and emotional reactivity can increase dramatically the few days before the onset of bleeding. At the National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda, Maryland, David Rubinow and colleagues have been studying menstrual mood changes. They've now found direct evidence that the hormone fluctuations during the menstrual cycle increase brain circuit excitability, as measured by the startle reflex, which most of us think of as being jumpy. It is also related to the stress response. This helps explain why women often feel more irritable during maximal hormone withdrawal. Although 80% of women are only mildly affected by these monthly hormone changes, about 10% say they get extremely edgy and easily upset. Females whose ovaries make the most estrogen and progesterone are more resistant to stress because they have more serotonin, the chemical that makes you feel at ease, cells in their brain. Those women with the least estrogen and progesterone are more sensitive to stress and have fewer serotonin brain cells. For these most stress-sensitive individuals, the final days before their periods start can be hell on earth. Hostility, hopeless feelings of depression, plans for suicide, panic attacks, fear, and uncontrollable bouts of crying and rage can plague them. Hormone and serotonin changes can result in a malfunction in the brain's seat of judgment, the prefrontal cortex, and dramatic, uncontrolled emotions can push through more easily from the primitive parts of the brain. Shayna was in this category. During the week or two before her period, she was constantly in trouble for talking out of turn and being disruptive in class. She was obnoxious and aggressive one minute, bursting into tears the next. Pretty soon, her moods turned wild, and she began to intimidate her parents, peers, and teachers. Repeated meetings with the principal and school counselor did nothing to curb her outbursts, and when her parents finally sent her to a pediatrician, he too was baffled by her extreme behavior. It was a female teacher who noticed that Shayna's behavior was at its worst during 2 weeks of each month. The rest of the time, she was like her old self, or more like a typical teen, sometimes moody and oversensitive, but mostly cooperative. On a hunch, the teacher called me at the clinic to suggest that Shayna had bad PMS. Shayna's mood and personality swings, while extreme, were no surprise. In 20 years of practice in psychiatry and women's health, I've seen hundreds of girls and women with similar problems. Most blame themselves for flare-ups of bad behavior. Some have been in psychotherapy for years trying to get to the bottom of their recurrent sadness or anger. Many have been regularly accused of substance abuse, bad attitudes, and bad intentions. Most of these assumptions are unjust, and all of them completely miss the point. These adolescent girls and adult women have regular, dramatic shifts in their moods and behavior because, in fact, the very structure of their brains is changing from day to day and from week to week. The medical name for an extreme emotional reaction during the weeks before the period, triggered by ovarian estrogen and progesterone hormones, is premenstrual dysphoric disorder, or PMDD. Women who have committed crimes while suffering from PMDD have successfully used it as a defense in France and England by establishing temporary insanity. Other common conditions, such as menstrual migraine, are also caused by increased brain circuit excitability and decreased calming right before the period starts. Researchers at the National Institute of Mental Health found that the emotion and mood changes these women experience during the menstrual cycle disappear when the ovaries are blocked from producing fluctuating hormones. It may be, they conclude, that women with PMDD are in some sense allergic or hypersensitive to fluctuations in their own estrogen and progesterone during the cycle. 50 years ago, one successful treatment for PMDD was removing the ovaries surgically. At the time, this was the only way to remove the hormone fluctuation. Instead of removing Shayna's ovaries, I gave her a hormone to take every day, the continuous birth control pill, to keep her estrogen and progesterone at moderately high but constant levels and prevent her ovaries from sending out the big fluctuations of hormones that were upsetting her brain. With her estrogen and progesterone at constant levels, her brain was kept calmer and her serotonin levels stabilized. For some girls, I add a medication such as an antidepressant or a so-called SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, which can further stabilize and improve the brain's serotonin level. In other words, improve one's mood and sense of well-being. The following month, her teacher called me to report that Shayna was back to her good old self again, cheerful and getting good grades. Risk-taking and aggression in teen girls. The day Shayna screamed that she wanted to go to the beach, Lauren had been concerned about her daughter's boyfriend, Jeff. Jeff was from a very wealthy and permissive family, and at 15, Shayna had already had sex with him. Jeff's parents allowed them to do it in their house, a fact Shayna had kept hidden from her parents until she had a pregnancy scare. Since Jeff wasn't going away, Lauren decided it was best to get to know him. And the more she did, the more she liked him. Jeff was lavishing Shayna with gifts, something Lauren wasn't thrilled about, but she didn't want to hurt his feelings. And Shayna was happy when he was around. She made deals with her parents. "Come on, Mom, I'm really stressed out, and if he comes over for an hour, I'll feel better. I promise to finish my work after he leaves." She often snuck him back in, and the two were thick as thieves. Shayna had been seeing Jeff for 8 months. The day after she told her mom how much she loved him, Shayna showed up at home after school with Mike, a boy she had sworn was just a friend. When Lauren went up to check on them, the door was closed. When she opened it, they were, as she put it, sucking face. Since she had allowed Shayna to be sexually involved with Jeff, Lauren didn't know what to do. It was clear that Shayna's impulses were getting out of control. A girl's emotional centers become highly responsive at puberty. Her brain's emotion and impulse control system, the prefrontal cortex, has sprouted many more cells by the age of 12. But the connections are still thin and immature. As a result, a teen girl's mood changes are more rapid and dramatic, resulting in part from the increased emotional impulses blasting in from the amygdala. Her prefrontal cortex is like an old dial-up modem receiving signals from broadband. It can't handle the increased traffic from the amygdala, and it often becomes overwhelmed. Teenagers, therefore, often cling to an idea and run with it, not stopping to consider the consequences. They become resentful of any authority that wants to head off their impulses. My patient Joan, for example, remained in upstate New York the summer after she graduated from boarding school. An honor student, she had been involved with a local guy who didn't graduate high school, had been in juvenile detention, and at age 16 had fathered a child. She ran around with him all summer, and when it came time to leave for college, she thought about it twice. She wanted to stay with him. When her parents threatened to come up, take her car, and drag her off to college, she ran away with her boyfriend. She did come to her senses and go to college, but it was a long time before she spoke civilly to her parents again. It's tough for the teen brain to come up with good judgment in these situations. Remember Romeo and Juliet? If only the two lovers had known that their brain circuits were under major reconstruction. If only they'd known that their sex hormones were causing brain cells to grow and sprout extensions, and that it would take several years to form structurally sound connections once those extensions were plugged into the correct outlets in mature prefrontal cortexes. Juliet's brain would have matured 2 or 3 years earlier than Romeo's, though, so she may have come to her senses sooner than he. These unfinished, unmyelinated extension cords, most prominent in the connections from the emotion center of the amygdala to the emotional control center of the prefrontal cortex, need to be coated with a substance called myelin that allows for fast conduction before they can function reliably under stress. This may not happen until the late teens or early adult years. Without the fast connection to the prefrontal cortex, big downloads of emotional impulses often result in immediate, raw behaviors and circuit overload. When it is upset by an unwanted parental restriction such as, "We know you were drinking at the party and you're too involved with boys and your grades are going down, so you're grounded," the teen girl amygdala may not respond with much more than, "I hate you." But watch out for the subtle signs of rebellion that can ensue. She'll find another way to undermine you. Karen, a former patient of mine who is now a tenured professor of biochemistry, told me a story that illustrates this teen reality. She grew up in a small town in Washington State where many students dropped out of high school to work for the lumber companies in the area. Her girlfriends got jobs as cooks or secretaries in the lumber camps or got married and almost immediately became pregnant. By the time she was a sophomore in high school, Karen was desperate to get away from home. She was determined to go to college, a radical idea in a town where only the teachers, the doctor, and the librarian were college graduates. Her parents accused her of living in a fantasy world. They didn't have the money to send her, and what did she think she could do with a college degree when she would likely get knocked up by the time she was 20? Their scorn made Karen even more determined to find a way out. At 18, she wanted to stay in school and graduate, but she was old enough to get a job as a go-go dancer in one of the local bars that serviced the lumberjacks who came into town to spend their paychecks. She moved in with her boyfriend and worked nights at the bar. Too young to go topless, she still managed to earn $20 tips, which the customers would stick in her G-string. Not exactly the typical line of work for a future biochemistry professor. But Karen earned enough money to pay for her first semester at college, and after that, her grades were rewarded with a full scholarship. Now that Karen is herself the mother of three teenagers, two girls and a boy, she tries to imagine how she would react if her 18-year-old daughter announced that she had just gotten herself a job as a pole dancer in a bar. She herself had avoided any dangerous incidents, but her go-go gig could have turned out otherwise. Changing hormonal conditions in girls' brains through the menstrual cycle add even more volatility to the mix. If estrogen and progesterone simply increased during the teen years and remained at that new, higher level, the female brain would permanently readjust. But, as we have seen, these hormones come in waves. Given the fact that the teen brain is undergoing major changes, especially in areas that are particularly sensitive to shifts in hormones, puberty can be an outrageously impulsive time for many girls. Under no stress on a good week of the menstrual cycle, the teen girl's prefrontal cortex may function normally. At those times, she may have good judgment and appropriate behavior. But some stress, like a disappointment or a bad grade, on a PMS day, may derail the prefrontal cortex, causing an exaggerated emotional response and out-of-control behavior, such as yelling and slamming doors. What at my house we call a meltdown. Testosterone surges in teen boys may have similar brain effects, but these have not been studied yet. Hormone surges at this age can make a mild stress or a seemingly small event feel like a catastrophe. Calming down the fired-up teen girl amygdala can prove difficult. Many girls turn to drugs, alcohol, and food. Either they'll stop eating or they'll binge when they're under stress. As a parent of teens, you have the job of ignoring much of what they say. Don't take any impulsive or emotional tirades seriously. Stay calm. Teens state their intentions and feel them with such passion that you can be persuaded in spite of yourself. Just remember, your teen daughter's impulse control circuits can't handle the input. Like it or not, you must provide the control while her brain cannot. Even though Joan hated her parents for threatening to come and take her car away, they did the right thing, she told me years later. It was their job to exercise the good judgment that she lacked at that time. Depression. It wasn't long before even Mike began to realize Shayna's impulses were out of control. If she could turn on a dime about Jeff, she could change her mind about him too, and he decided to break it off. A few of Shayna's friends were also mad at her over how she treated Jeff, and she was becoming isolated. Up until then, Shayna had been doing well. She was writing for the school newspaper, was becoming serious about sculpting, and was going to have a good pick of colleges. Her teachers loved her creativity and spark. But when Mike broke it off, everything changed. Shayna lost a ton of weight. She stopped doing well in school. She let the school paper down by not writing stories that were assigned. She couldn't concentrate or do her homework, couldn't sleep, and was obsessed with her weight and appearance, and couldn't get her brain to stop thinking about him. I could see a few scratches on her arm and realized she was cutting. I was quite alarmed, since this is the period when the female-to-male ratio for depression doubles. Boys and girls have the same risk of depression before the hormones of puberty. But by age 15, girls are twice as likely to suffer from depression. Genetics may also play a role in female depression. In certain families with high depression rates, for example, researchers have found a mutation in a gene called CREB1 that puts teenage females, but not males, at higher risk for clinical depression. Shayna's mother and grandmother had had serious depressions in their teens, and a female cousin had committed suicide. These facts put her at serious risk. Shayna had a true clinical depression. I started her on an antidepressant, stayed in close contact, and did weekly cognitive therapy. Within 4 to 6 weeks, she was able to concentrate again, take her final exams, and stop obsessing over both Mike and her weight. The biology of mean girls. Hormonal surges can turn nice girls mean at the drop of an egg, and so can sexual competition, which is strong and pivotal among teenage girls. This competition, however, plays out with a different set of rules than does that among teen boys. Girls are driven to gather in cliques. But there is another side in which these cliques are at war. Teen girls, we know, can be devastatingly mean. When females are competing with other females, they often use more subtle tools, such as spreading rumors to undermine a rival. This way, they can cover their tracks. I wasn't trying to be mean. I'm sorry. Such tactics lessen the risk of destroying the bond that the teen girl brain sees as essential to survival. But also essential to survival is sexual competition. I can remember when I was in 7th grade, there was one girl who was beautiful, and the other girls were very jealous because she got so much attention from the boys. She was also shy, so others assumed she was a snob. One day, the not-as-pretty girl who sat directly behind her in a class took a wad of bubblegum out of her mouth and stuck it in the pretty girl's hair. Unknowingly, the pretty girl began to twist the gum into such a mess that the only way to get it out was to cut off her seductive locks. The queen of mean who put the gum in this girl's hair felt triumphant. her biological imperative to compete for sexual attractiveness had a momentary victory. The hormones usually associated with aggression in both males and females are androgens. They begin to rise early in puberty and continue until they peak at age 19 in females and 21 in males. The three main androgens that women make are testosterone, DHEA, and androstenedione. In a study at the University of Utah, the most in-your-face aggressive teenage girls were found to have high levels of the androstenedione androgen. Acne is a good clue that your teen's androgen levels are high. Girls with high levels of testosterone and DHEA also tend to have sexual intercourse earlier. By the time I saw Shayna at age 15, she not only had acne and fully developed breasts, but had been having sex for the past year. Aggressive impulses can fluctuate with the hormones of the menstrual cycle. During some weeks of the cycle, the teen girl will be more interested in social connection. During other weeks, she'll be more interested in power over boys and other girls. This association implies that the higher amounts of androgens made by the ovaries during weeks 2 and 3 increase aggression levels in women and teens. Less empathy, social connection, and affiliation have been associated with higher androgen levels in both sexes. We can't know for sure, but Shayna's higher androgen levels on certain weeks of her cycle may have been triggering her aggressive outbursts. Not only is aggression reduced when androgen levels are low, but sex drive is decreased too. Teens taking oral contraceptives have reduced aggression and sex drive because the contraceptive suppresses the ovaries, so they make less androgen. Although both men and women make testosterone, men make more than 10 times as much, meaning that their sex drive is much greater than women's. Scientists know that it is probably not just androgens that increase aggressive spirit and ambition in women, but estrogen too. In the same study at the University of Utah, women who were the most outspoken and had the highest self-regard also had the highest levels of estrogen, testosterone, and androstenedione. They also ranked themselves above how their peers ranked them. And these young women were routinely rated by others as the most boastful. Of course, a hormone alone does not cause a behavior. Hormones merely raise the likelihood that under certain circumstances a behavior will occur. And just as there is no one seat of aggression in the brain, there is no one hormone of aggression. But achieving success and attaining power in the world requires some aggression for both sexes. These hormones change teens' reality and perceptions of themselves as sexual, assertive, and independent beings in the world. During the teen years, a girl's brain circuits go through massive growth and pruning. It's as if she is given a whole new set of extension cords and needs to figure out which ones to plug into which outlets. The full power of her female brain circuits can now start to be manifested. And where will they push her? Right into the arms of a man. Chapter 3, Love and Trust. Melissa, a brassy San Francisco film producer, really wanted to fall in love. Her career was finally chugging along at a steady pace, and at age 32, she was ready to move into the next phase of her life. She now wanted a family and the continuity of a relationship with a man who would stick by her for more than a few sexually charged months. The only problem was that she couldn't seem to connect with the right one. She would go on countless dates through setups or with men she met on the internet, but none was touching off the flurry of butterflies in her stomach or that intense, irrational need to be around him all the time. One night, her best friend, Leslie, called and asked Melissa to go salsa dancing. But Melissa wasn't in the mood. She wanted to stay home, relax, and watch TV. But Leslie was relentless, so Melissa acquiesced. She tousled her curly hair to look sexy, put on a swirly skirt, her new red suede heels, and bee-sting red lipstick, which made her mouth pop out. She grabbed a taxi over to the dance club. Leslie was already inside drinking a margarita when Melissa arrived. As they were getting loose to hit the dance floor, Melissa saw a tall, handsome man with a sculpted face, olive skin, and a shock of nearly black hair across the room. "Wow, he's gorgeous," she said. She turned back to Leslie and whispered for her to glance over at the man, but it was too late. He was already walking toward them. Melissa was locked in gaze with this stranger. A wave of energy shot up her back. It was the feeling she hadn't experienced in all the months of her bad dates. There was something vaguely familiar about him. Who is that? She whispered under her breath to Leslie as her brain's cortex scanned her memory banks. No match was found, but all her attention circuits were now on mating alert status. Is he here alone or with someone? She wondered. She looked around for one of the gorgeous women who always seemed to be attached to these perfect-looking guys, but saw no one. And he was still walking toward her. The closer he got, the more unfocused Melissa became on her friend's story. She grabbed her drink tightly. Her eyes and attention were riveted on him, taking in every detail. His leather Armani shoes, his sexy black cords, and no wedding ring on his left finger. Everything else dropped into the background as her brain honed to make contact. She felt she was falling in love. The mating impulse had taken over. "Hi, I'm Rob," he said, leaning against the bar nervously. His voice was pure velvet. "Have we met before?" Melissa was unable to hear his words. She could only bask in the feel of him, his earthy smell, and his devilish green eyes. The dance of romance had begun, and its choreographer was not her friend or a matchmaker. It was the biology of Melissa's brain. We know that the symmetry of physiques and faces that entrance us, the moves that seduce us, and the heart-pounding passion of attraction are all hardwired into our brain's love drive by evolution. Short and long-term chemistry between two people may seem accidental, but the reality is that our brains are pre-programmed to know better. They subtly but firmly steer us toward partners who can boost our odds in the sweepstakes of human reproduction. Melissa's brain is beginning to imprint Rob. Her hormones are surging. As he tells her that he is a marketing consultant who lives in the loft in Potrero Hill and musters up the nerve to ask her to dance, her brain, faster than a supercomputer, calculates the qualities that might put him in the running as a mating partner. Already some green light is flashing that he's a good one. And wham! Hot, knee-buckling waves of attraction and desire are flooding her body with a heady rush of dopamine, sparking euphoria and excitement. Her brain has also ordered her a shot of testosterone, the hormone that stokes sexual desire. As Rob speaks, he is also sizing up Melissa at a closer view. If his calculations come out positive, he'll get a neurochemical jolt too, prodding him to try to hook up with her. With their love circuits mutually revved up, the two move into the dance floor and spend the next few hours locked in sweaty salsa rhythms. At 2 a.m., the music slows down and the club begins to empty. Leslie has gone home hours earlier. Standing on the corner, Melissa says that she has to go and flirtatiously turns on her high heels. "Wait," Rob says. "I don't have your number. I want to see you again." "Google me and you'll find me," she replies, smiling and jumping into a cab. Now the chase begins. For men and women, the initial calculations about romance are unconscious, and they're very different. In short-term couplings, for example, men are chasers and women are choosers. That's not sex stereotyping. It's our inheritance from ancestors who learned, over millions of years, how to propagate their genes. As Darwin noted, males of all species are made for wooing females, and females typically choose among their suitors. This is the brain architecture of love, engineered by the reproductive winners in evolution. Even the shapes, faces, smells, and ages of the mates we choose are influenced by patterns set millennia ago. The truth is, we're much more predictable than we think. Over the course of our evolution as a species, our brains have learned how to spot the healthiest mates, those most likely to give us children, and those whose resources and commitment can help our offspring survive. The lessons that early men and women learned are deeply encoded in our modern brains as neurological love circuits. They are present from the moment we're born and activated at puberty by fast-acting cocktails of neurochemicals. It's an elegant system. Our brains size up a potential partner, and if he fits our ancestral wish list, we get a jolt of chemicals that dizzy us with a rush of laser-focused attraction. Call it love or infatuation. It's the first step down an ancient pair-bonding path. The gates have opened to the courtship mating parenting brain program. Melissa may not have wanted to meet anyone that night, but her brain had other plans that are deep and primitive. When it saw Rob across the room, a signal went off for mating and long-term attachment. And she was lucky that his brain felt the same way. Each of them will come up against anxiety, threats, and mind-numbing joys over which they have little control because now biology is building their future together. Mindset on mating. As Melissa struts along the city streets, sips her latte, or cruises the internet for potential dates while she's waiting for Rob to locate her number on her website, she did tell him the name of her latest film, so if he is smart, he'll find her. It's not easy to believe that what's inside her cranium is a Stone Age brain. But that's the case, according to scientists who study the mate attraction engineering of the human mind. We spent more than 99% of the millions of years it took human beings to evolve living in primitive conditions. As a result, the theory goes, our brains developed to solve the kinds of problems that those early human ancestors encountered. The most important challenge they faced was reproduction. It wasn't just a matter of having children. It was making sure those children lived long enough to propagate their genes. Early people whose mating choices produced more surviving offspring succeeded in passing their genes on. Their specific brain systems for courtship attraction were more successful. ancestors who made the wrong reproductive moves left no imprint on the future of the species. As a result, the brain wiring of the best Stone Age reproducers became the standard issue circuitry of modern humans. This courtship circuitry is what is commonly known as falling in love. We may think we're a lot more sophisticated than Fred or Wilma Flintstone, but our basic mental outlook and equipment are the same. That our mental instincts haven't changed in millions of years may explain why women, worldwide, look for the same ideal qualities in a long-term mate, according to the evolutionary psychologist David Buss. For over 5 years, Buss studied the mate preferences of more than 10,000 individuals in 37 cultures around the world, from West Germans and Taiwanese to Mbuti Pygmies and Aleut Eskimos. He discovered that, in every culture, women are less concerned with a potential husband's visual appearance and more interested in his material resources and social status. Rob had told Melissa he was a marketing consultant. They were a dime a dozen in San Francisco, and Melissa had seen more than a few go out of business. She didn't realize that this thought was making it hard for her to figure out if Rob was Mr. Right or Mr. Right Now. Buss's findings may be uncomfortable at a time when many females are achieving at high levels and are proud of their social and financial independence. Nevertheless, he found that in all 37 cultures, females value these qualities in a mate much more than males do, regardless of the female's own assets and earning capacity. Melissa may be an independent economic unit, but she wants her partner to provide too. Female bowerbirds share this preference by choosing to mate with the male who has built the most beautiful nest. My husband jokes that he's like a male bowerbird, since he built a beautiful house several years before we met, and it was ready and waiting for me. Researchers have found that women also look for mates who are, on average, at least 4 inches taller and 3.5 years older. These female mate preferences are universal, and as a result, scientists conclude, they're part of the inherited architecture of the female brain's mate choice system and are presumed to serve a purpose. According to Robert Trivers, a pioneering evolutionary biologist at Rutgers University, choosing a mate based on these attributes is a savvy investment strategy. Human females have a limited number of eggs and invest far more in bearing and raising children than males do. So it pays for women to be extra careful with their family jewels. This is why Melissa didn't jump into bed with Rob on the first night, even though the dopamine and testosterone surging through her brain's attraction circuits made him hard to resist. It's also why she kept a number of other guys on her dance card. While a man can impregnate a woman with one act of intercourse and walk away, a woman is left with 9 months of pregnancy, the perils of childbirth, months of breastfeeding, and the daunting task of trying to ensure that child's survival. Female ancestors who faced these challenges alone were likely to have been less successful in propagating their genes. Though single motherhood has become fashionable among some sets of modern women, it remains to be seen how well this model will succeed. Even today, in some primitive cultures, the presence of a father triples children's survival rate. As a result, the safest bet for females is to partner long-term with males who are likely to stick around, protect them and their children, and improve their access to food, shelter, and other resources. Melissa was smart to take her time and make sure Rob was a good catch. Her dream was a husband whom she loved and who loved and worshipped her back. Her worst fear was a man who might be unfaithful, the way her father was to her mother. After the night at the dance club, she got a number of positive clues. Rob was taller, older, and appeared financially comfortable. In the grand Stone Age scheme of things, he fit the bill, but it still wasn't clear whether he was the long-term type. Chemical attraction. If Melissa's ancient brain circuitry was scanning for assets and protection, what was Rob's brain looking for in a long-term partner? According to Buss and other scientists, something completely different. Worldwide, men prefer physically attractive wives between ages 20 and 40, who are an average of 2.5 years younger than they are. They also want potential long-term mates to have clear skin, bright eyes, full lips, shiny hair, and curvy hourglass figures. The fact that these mate preferences hold true in every culture indicates that they're part of men's hardwired inheritance from their ancient forefathers. It wasn't just that Rob had a thing for girls with shiny curls. Melissa's hair triggered his ancient attraction wiring. Why would these particular criteria top men's lists? From a practical perspective, all of these traits, superficial as they may seem, are strong visual markers of fertility. Whether or not men know it consciously, their brains know that female fertility offers them the biggest reproductive payoff for their investment. With tens of millions of sperm, men are capable of producing an almost unlimited number of offspring as long as they can find enough fertile females to have sex with. As a result, their key task is to pair up with women who are likely to be fertile and reproduce. Pairing with infertile women would be a waste of their genetic futures. So over millions of years, male brain wiring evolved to scan women for quick visual clues to their fertility. Age, of course, is one important factor. Health is another. A high activity level, youthful gait, symmetrical physical features, smooth skin, lustrous hair, and lips plumped by estrogen are easily observable signs of age, fertility, and health. So it's no wonder women are reaching for the plumping effects of collagen injections and the wrinkle smoothing of Botox. Shape, too, is a remarkably good indicator of fertility, breast implants notwithstanding. Before puberty, males and females have very similar body shapes and waist-to-hip ratios. Once the reproductive hormones kick in, however, healthy females develop curvier shapes with waists that are about one-third narrower than the hips. Women with that body type have more estrogen and become pregnant more easily and at a younger age than those with waists that are closer in size to their hips. A thin waist also gives an instant clue to a woman's reproductive availability, since pregnancy radically alters her silhouette. Social reputation is often a factor in male assessment, since the most reproductively successful males also need to pick women who will mate only with them. Men want to ensure their paternity, but also to be able to count on a woman's mothering skills to make sure that their offspring thrive. If Melissa had immediately gone to bed with Rob or showed off to him about all the guys she had had, his Stone Age brain might have judged that she would be unfaithful or had a bad reputation. that she was affectionate on the dance floor and went home at a proper hour in a taxi showed him she was a high-quality lady with whom to mate long-term. Calculating potential danger. Rob left a message on her machine, and Melissa waited a few days before calling him back. And although they had kissed on the first date, she had no plans of going to bed with him until she knew more about him. He was incredibly funny and charming and seemed to have his life in order, but she needed to be sure on a gut level that she could trust him. The brain's anxiety circuits usually fire around strangers. Her amygdala's fear circuits were still turned on full force. A natural cautiousness towards strangers is part of the brain wiring of both males and females. But women in particular give early, careful scrutiny to a man's likely level of commitment when looking for a mate. Seduction and abandonment by males is an old ruse, going back to the beginning of our species. One study found that young college males admitted to depicting themselves as kinder, more sincere, and more trustworthy than they really are. Some anthropologists speculate that natural selection favored men who were good at deceiving women and getting them to agree to have sex. Females, as a result, had to get even better at spotting male lies and exaggerations, and the female brain is now well adapted to this task. A study by the Stanford University psychologist Eleanor Maccabee showed, for example, that girls learn to tell the difference between reality and fairy tales, or just pretend play, earlier than boys. By adulthood, modern females have fine-tuned their superior ability to read emotional nuance in tone of voice, eye gaze, and facial expressions. As a result of this extra cautiousness, the typical female brain isn't as ready to admit to being overwhelmed by infatuation or the sheer excitement of sexual behavior as is the male. Women do reach the same or a higher romantic end point, but they're often slower to confess to being in love and more careful than males in the beginning weeks and months of a relationship. Male brains have a different neurological love wiring. Brain imaging studies of women in love show more activity in many more areas, especially gut feelings, attention, and memory circuits, while men in love show more activity in high-level visual processing areas. These heightened visual connections may also explain why men tend to fall in love at first sight more easily than women. Once a person is in love, the cautious, critical thinking pathways in the brain shut down. Evolution may have made these in-love brain circuits to ensure we find a mate and then focus in exclusively on that one person, according to Helen Fisher, an anthropologist at Rutgers University. Not thinking too critically about the loved one's faults would aid this process. In her study on being in love, more women than men said their beloved's faults don't matter much to them, and women scored higher on the test of passionate love. The brain in love. Melissa and Rob were talking on the phone almost every night. Every Saturday, they would meet in the park to take Rob's dog for a walk, or at Melissa's apartment to watch the dailies of her latest film. Rob was feeling stable in his job and had finally stopped talking about his former girlfriend, Ruth. This waning attachment to Ruth gave Melissa a clue that she wasn't just a rebound and that he was ready to focus in on her exclusively. She had already involuntarily fallen in love with him but hadn't told him yet. She began warming to his physical affection, allowing her sex drive to catch up with her love drive. Finally, after 3 months, Melissa and Rob fell passionately into bed after a day lying in the sun at the park, totally entranced by each other. The pair was tumbling into full-blown, consummated love. Falling in love is one of the most irrational behaviors or brain states imaginable for both men and women. The brain becomes illogical in the throes of new romance, literally blind to the shortcomings of the lover. It is an involuntary state. Passionately being in love, or so-called infatuation love, is now a documented brain state. It shares brain circuits with states of obsession, mania, intoxication, thirst, and hunger. It is not an emotion, but it does intensify or decreases other emotions. The being in love circuits are primarily a motivation system, which is different from the brain's sex drive area but overlaps with it. This fevered brain activity runs on hormones and neurochemicals such as dopamine, estrogen, oxytocin, and testosterone. The brain circuits that are activated when we are in love match those of the drug addict desperately craving the next fix. The amygdala, the brain's fear alert system, and the anterior cingulate cortex, the brain's worrying and critical thinking system, are turned way down when the love circuits are running full blast. Much the same thing happens when people take ecstasy. The normal wariness humans have toward strangers is switched off, and the love circuits are dialed up. So romantic love is a natural ecstasy high. The classic symptoms of early love are also similar to the initial effects of drugs such as amphetamines, cocaine, and opiates like heroin, morphine, and OxyContin. These narcotics trigger the brain's reward circuit, causing chemical releases and effects similar to those of romance. In fact, there's some truth to the notion that people can become addicted to love. Romantic partners, especially in the first 6 months, crave the ecstatic feeling of being together and may feel helplessly dependent on each other. Studies of passionate love show this brain state lasts for roughly 6 to 8 months. This is such an intense state that the beloved's best interest, well-being, and survival become as important as, or more important than, one's own. During this early phase of love, Melissa was intensely memorizing every detail of Rob. When she had to go to L.A. for a week to show a piece of her new film project at a conference, both struggled with the separation. This was not just some fantasy, it was the pain of neurochemical withdrawal. During times of physical separation, when touching and caressing is impossible, a deep longing, almost a hunger, for the beloved can set in. Some people don't even realize how bonded or in love they are until they feel this tugging at their heartstrings when the beloved is absent. We are used to thinking of this longing as only psychological, but it's actually physical. The brain is virtually in a drug withdrawal state. "Absence makes the heart grow fonder," your mother would say as you were moaning in pain because he was away. I can remember the early days of dating my husband, when I already knew he was the one, but he didn't yet. During a brief separation, he decided we should get married. Thank goodness for dopamine and oxytocin withdrawal. His heartstrings finally got the attention of his very self-sufficient and independent male brain, as his friends and family will tell you. During a separation, motivation for reunion can reach a fever pitch in the brain. Rob was so desperate in the middle of the week for physical contact with Melissa that he flew down to see her for a day. Once reunion takes place, All the components of the original loving bond can be reestablished by dopamine and oxytocin. Activities such as caressing, kissing, gazing, hugging, and orgasm can replenish the chemical